all you jive hustlers, you stone foxes, you mean dudes, watch out. The Godfather of Harlem is doing it again. There's only one stud who could rip off New York, ruin Rome, and stay alive to run a number in Africa.
Like stealing candy from a baby.
Super strong, supernatural, and
the baddest cat that ever walked the earth.
Damn, brother, you have become one violent dude.
I might not be the baddest man in the world, but I'm in the top two, and my father is getting old.
Pornography presents Marcel Sugar with the support of Westmont.
His business is pleasure. He sells the soft stuff.
Rated R. It's nasty.
Hi, I'm Sam Sugar. Welcome to Podnography Show 12. Podnography is a weekly look at the world of sex and pornography via news, reviews, and interviews. Along with our usual review of the past week at Fleshbot, this week's show includes a review of Digital Dreamgirls, an art porn website by J. Stephen Hicks, and an interview with the man who makes porn for people who don't like porn, Tony Comstock. Each week, Fleshbot stops at Chevy in the industrial part of town and talks to this woman.
Hey, babe, you want to go out? You want to go out, honey? Spend any money? Come here, cutie. Hey, come here. Did you hear what I say? I said, come here. Come here, daddy. You look so good.
Here's what they link to this week. This week, Violet found pictures of body-painted Playboy models. And by Playboy, I mean a man the age of your grandfather who's ingested more drugs than the average lab-bound rhesus monkey. And by model, I mean a woman who's paid to strip off and be quiet unless Hef asks you a question. How many times do I have to say that? The pictures came from the Playboy Mansion's Karma Party. And by mansion, I mean a kitsch house which is available to rent for corporate events via Playboy Enterprises. There didn't appear to be any actual karma going down. No men who'd once rejected gawky teenage girls being forced to introduce their dumpy wives to the swans they'd once made cry. There was a lot of body painting, though. For fans of body painting, a lot of, is that nipple or part of the leopard print action? On a more serious note, Fleshbot reported on the 3rd US Circuit Court of Appeals, who are now hearing arguments in the Rob Black case, which he won in January of this year. He's been charged with obscenity, and now the government is appealing and trying to make sure that he goes to prison. It's an interesting case, almost impossible for Extreme to lose given the depth of precedent which protects speech in US law, regardless of how explicit that speech is. Extreme Associates, run by the infamous Rob Black, porn stereotype, faux scumbag, and master media manipulator, makes the kind of violent, artless porn that offends as many people as it enthralls. Mr. Black's the last person most liberals or libertarians would choose to go to the mattresses for. That is, of course, why he's the government's primary target. I wish him luck that he shouldn't need, and will keep an eye on this case to see if the current administration, loading a Supreme Court with fanatical judicial incompetence, will succeed in making pornography illegal. There's a lot I could say about Charlotte Church's ass. One word that springs to mind rhymes with barge. Another rhymes with flowy, and brings to mind freshly baked bread. Of course, for the true ass man, the pictures Fleshbot found of her underslung Welsh hills are doubtless evidence of outstanding natural beauty. Personally, I can't find myself too sexually aroused on any level by a body part women share with my father. But check the pics out and make your own mind up. I'm not going to do everything for you. This week's weirdness comes care of Nancy Farmer, a British woman who dresses Barbie up like the whore she is, and then sets up sexually charged dioramas in which Ken gets to find out that being a sissy bitch means more than wearing yellow trousers. It's strangely arousing stuff to look at, and the most novel use of Barbie since I got drunk after an ACLU meeting and woke up in Cedars-Sinai to witness my sixth finger being cut out of a puppet I'd made with half a Barbie and my junk. You should have seen it, it was pretty cool. It had balls for feet and everything. Email me if you're having trouble picturing it. Now that Paris Hilton exists, old tramps like Sharon Stone have to work harder to shock, and, as she discovered this week, compared to the heiress porn star, anything short of pulling a string of razors from her clam while humming "She works hard for her money" is going to seem classy. The photos Fleshbot found, of Stone showing up at a store opening wearing nothing but a trench coat, prove that a genuinely beautiful woman in her 50s, she's got to be 50 by now, right, is still a sounder lust object than a rail-thin Trustafarian with less mental processing power than her cell phone. Okay, I'll admit it. This item's just an excuse for me to express my profound loathing of Paris Hilton. I should really devote a show to it. That was my pick of Fleshbot this week. For the pictures that go with these stories and more besides, visit fleshbot.com and dive into the pink.
Hi, this is Ms. Kitka, host of the brand spanking new video podcast, Kitcast. Join me every week for sex news and sexy interviews covering the worlds of porn, strippers, and sex. Visit MsKitka.com today to download the latest episode of KitCast.
J. Stephen Hicks is among the very top tier of commercial erotic photographers. For anyone under 30, he's the guy who found a lot of the women we grew up seeing on the web and in magazines. That photo set of Veronica Zemanova covered in wet sand at the beach? Yeah, that's him. Kyla Cole? He discovered her. If that wasn't enough to be thankful for, he has also been one of the most aggressive photographers when it comes to building an online identity. In a move of striking modesty, he called his site ddgirls.com. Conveniently, that's the pay site I'm going to review this week. Stephen's skill with a camera is doing what looks easy but isn't. Glamour. He's better than any other shooter I know at creating a look which you'd swear was natural light if it wasn't all a bit too perfect. His pictures carry a kind of music video reality that you don't often see in porn. He's also singularly good at finding models who, as Nigel Tufnell would say, go all the way to 11. He's created a feedback loop which works to everyone's benefit. He makes the women he photographs look incredible, word gets out, women want to shoot for him, he gets more incredible women to shoot, etc., etc. Everyone knows Stephen's the way to go for a certain type of hyper-real gloss. What also shines through, in an age of poorly used Photoshop, is that Stephen's work is processed gently. These women have pores and that downy hair at the bottom of their back, which makes it easy to believe that what you're looking at is real. Stephen shoots a lot and his site is massive. Tens of thousands of photos, all of them presented at monitor filling sizes and going back to 1997 when he first got online. On the video front, Stephen's got things right again. His movie clips are long, encoded at high bitrate, and presented as downloads. Perfect. One novel thing he does is on-set video interviews. Unlike me, he provides sexy video montages along with his interviews, and they're fun. For example, here's a little of him talking to Janine.
Having a good time?
Yes.
How was the shoot?
The shoot was fantastic.
Yeah?
Yes. I was only expecting one shoot today, and I got here and we whipped out three nice, juicy layouts.
Yeah, good deal.
I think everybody's going to be very happy.
Yes, definitely. Well, you're a seasoned pro, so
yes.
It's
season froze.
It's always,
that's me.
It's always very easy, you know, when somebody knows what they're doing, and you're very beautiful, and
you
work great with the camera. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
Where am I from? I am from La Mirada, California.
La Mirada, California. Yes. So you've been a California girl your whole life?
Whole life.
Yeah, how do you like that?
I love it. This is home. No other place I'd rather be. And, I've checked out my share of other towns and, there's some, cool places, but this is home.
How long have you been modeling, Janine?
Well, let's see. I started when I was 18. I am now 33 and a half.
Wow. So. You look fabulous at 33.
Wow.
You really do. You look fabulous.
Thank you. But yeah, so it's been quite some time. I know, shooting with Stephen Hicks, he started shooting me when I was 19. Yeah. 19 or 20. I think 19. Little boobies. They have since grown.
Quite a bit. How big are your boobies?
How big? What are they now? I guess they're a D, double D. That's a secret, so don't tell anybody I showed you.
Wow, those are some incredible areolas. So let's talk a little bit about everybody's favorite subject, sex.
Believe me, that interview is a whole lot more interesting if you're watching Janine pull herself out of a bikini while you're listening to it. If I have any criticism of the site, it's the usual refrain. Firstly, the site needs a blog. Tours have to die, and I swear I'm going to build one for free soon if people continue to miss the point. Secondly, the members area could do with a little clarification. There are tabs and buttons and text links everywhere. Although it looks great, it could be easier to navigate. That said, it's clearly a little messy due to the massive volume of material on offer, and that's a good thing. It's easy to think there's no point in joining a pay site if you've never been inside one. Kind of like wanking seems like the best thing ever if you've never actually been inside someone else. Damn, I'm deep. Anyway, DD Girls is evidence that some things are worth paying for. Highly recommended, even if it's just to see a little more Kyla.
Recognize, but the words might pass between us. So roll out.
Tony Comstock is based in New York and has subtly begun to change how people think about explicit adult material via his documentary-style sex films, notable for having none of the cheese, but containing all of the passion. We talked for well over 2 hours about a range of subjects, porn-related and otherwise. The best of what was said is here.
Hello, Tony.
Hello, Sam.
Well, thank you for taking time out to talk to me and the legions of people out there listening. I actually should stop saying things like legions. I've been using a lot of fascist imagery in my speech and my writing recently.
Whoa. Were the Romans fascists?
Well, you know, I don't think it's that the Romans were fascist. I think that it's fascists love the Romans so much. You know, the Romans to fascists are a bit like Wagner, you know, to fascists.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Kind of guilt by association.
They've been co-opted and corrupted.
Yeah,
You can't raise an eagle standard without people looking at you askance. Yeah,
exactly. There's no, you can't really march around goose-stepping and, you know, designing logos in white circles on red backgrounds without people looking at you funny. I just don't know what the world's coming to. It's hard, but there were really nasty people out there who don't have that guilt by association. Look at Wernher von Braun. I mean, I'm a big fan of the space race, but the guy was a pretty big fascist. And, you know, he's all cool and dandy, Mr. Kind of. It's really surreal to me to think that, you know, at NASA there was this guy who was a Nazi.
Well, much like porn, we make generous allowances to get what we need.
Da, da, da. What a segue. Tony has just co-opted the show. Well, you are a... I'm not sure whether you would describe yourself as a pornographer, but you're someone who runs a company that makes a good amount of pornography.
It's funny that you mentioned that. When I originally started, I was studying one thing, and just for the sake of a hobby, I took there was a night section offered of the basic photography class at my school, and I took it just completely on a lark. I didn't have any interest in, you know, I had never seen Blow Up, I didn't read Vogue magazine. I had no glamorous image of photography at all. I thought my sister had got a camera and it had all these buttons and knobs, and I thought it would be neat to learn how it worked. So I took this night section, and I swear, I mean, it wasn't, you know, two sessions into the course that I had my girlfriend's shirt off and I was taking pictures of her tits. And so I've had this long-standing interest in sexual imagery, erotic imagery, the what happens when you take things that are sexually arresting and you make photographs or images of them and create that chance to gaze without being looked back at. You know, if you're like doing like, you know, like, oh, hey, honey, I want to watch you masturbate. And you watch her, but it's in a funny kind of a way. It's not as much fun as watching a film of somebody masturbating, because you have to deal with the fact that they know that they're, when it's a real person,
yeah,
then something different is happening. And it's a different kind of pleasure than if you watch even a film of someone who, you know, watching a tape, you know, a dirty movie I've made of my wife, is different than watching her in real life do the same thing. And yeah, there's a way that you can enjoy it when the person isn't actually there that's different and offers pleasures that are unique to that experience. 10 years ago, being interested in this kind of stuff, I was very happy to say I was a pornographer, because that seemed like a very rebellious thing that I, you know, people, oh no, yeah, what you do is erotica. No, I make pictures of women with their legs spread that I expect and hope other people will look at and masturbate. That's pornography. But in the intervening 10 or 15 years since I felt like I was being such a rake to say, no, it's not erotica, it's porn. Porn has gotten so bad, and I don't mean misogynistic or circus act, or it's just become so, the level of craft across the board has become so low that to say that you're a pornographer is more a statement about the level of craft than it is about what you depict. And I'm not comfortable saying I'm a pornographer in that way, because it, you know, oh, porn. People, like, they know what that is, you know, and then people see my movies and then they try to come up with another word because they don't want to call it porn. They want to call it docurotica or rockumentary or sex education, heaven forbid, or anything, so that they're trying to find a way to communicate to their readers.
Yeah.
This isn't porn, and they're not trying to say that it's not dirty. They're trying to say it's, you know, they're not going to see any crew shadows pass across the back wall is what they're trying to say, or what I understand them trying to be, that they're trying to say.
It's funny you should mention that, because, I mean, that's kind of the same situation that in mainstream movies, when Asian, and particularly when Hong Kong action movies started getting hyped, it was really, in large part, that was possible. Because action movies being made in the West were so bad that they had become kind of sub-film. And to go into Blockbuster or to admit that you liked watching, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme movies was basically to label yourself as retarded. But suddenly you could be arty and you could be watching these movies which are exactly serve exactly the same purpose in their culture as Jean-Claude Van Damme movies do over here, but had been kind of layered with deeper significance simply because they were better made and better put together and, you know, more thoughtful. So, I mean, do you think there's going to be a similar kind of renaissance in the world of adult film?
Well, I mean, right now, I sent a note to the film critic at Time.com. He went, it was maybe not the most politic thing to say. He published it without getting in touch with me, and maybe I've, you know, stepped on some toes within the adult industry as a result of that. But in the wake of that, I thought, well, you know, he is the film critic for Time.com. I should send him my films because he's written some essays about what happened to real adult sex in movies, going back to some of the very edgy and provocative adult films of the early 70s. He's bemoaning the fact that only Mike Nichols is making films that deal with sexuality in a frank and adult fashion, and what happened 30 years ago? We had Carnal Knowledge, and we had Last Tango in Paris, and it really looked like, you know. And now in the intervening years, we have just these kind of like these adolescent space opera fantasy, you know, American Pie. It's either kind of a action adventure movie, or it's a teenage farce. But there are no adult movies, and adult movies need to have sex. Sex is a really, really important part of the experience of being an adult. It's central. And I thought, well, okay, he's kind of fucked me by publishing my letter and not even telling me that it was going to happen. You know, I got a note from Violet, congratulations, and I went and I read it, and I was like, oh. He's published my very impolitic comment on the adult industry. How nice. Well, maybe at least he'll watch my film, since he's expressed this forlornness that sex is not treated in an adult way. So I wrote him and I said, well, you know, who would want to do dance movies if you could only do them from the waist up? You know, it's not you can't do a good dance movie from the waist up, but what accomplished artist who wants to give the maximum expression to their vision would say, well, okay, I'll do musicals even though I'm prohibited from showing anything from the waist down. You'd say, no, I want to do violence because I have the full palette of the visual world if I do violence. I said, that's not me. I do want to do sex, even though to commit to showing sex from the waist down explicitly puts me in this kind of outside complete martyrdom, porn, or I'm an art filmmaker or whatever. It's definitely out in some fringe backwater. Silly me, I thought he'd respond to that, and I said, well, watch the first 3 minutes, you'll know if you want to sit through the rest of it after 3 minutes. Well, I never even heard back from him. I hope that there would be a renaissance, but by deciding I'm going to do any artist, me or anyone else, saying I'm going to do explicit sexuality, cinematic explicit sexuality, you put yourself so far out of the world of what people will regard seriously. Oh, porn. You know, I read a similar essay by Roger Ebert, also bemoaning that that cinema has become very adolescent, and what happened to these adult, frank movies. And I basically rewrote the letter so that it addressed his essay more directly, and sent him copies of my movies. Same thing. Put one in your DVD player. You'll know this time I was a little less ambitious. I said, you'll know inside of 30 seconds if you want to keep watching. Nothing. Now, I understand that both of these people are busy men, but not even the courtesy of a reply in either case.
Yeah, it's rude, and I happen to know personally, and I can bank on this, and, you know, this show will be taken off the web and I'll be sued, but I happen to know personally that Roger Ebert is a fan of adult movie. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that the man goes out and rents, you know, the latest Cantuerson tape, but I am saying that he is someone who has, you know, expressed a clear interest. And I think that's not particularly hidden. He's quite often, I know he's been involved in a few kind of Russ Meyer type things, but it's,
to argue his side of it, let's say that he did take Xanax and he put it in and he thought, wow, this is engaging. You know, is this a 5-star movie? No, but in the world of movies, it's in the world of not adult and the allowances that I referred to. Let's say he looked at it and he said, in the world of movies, this is a genuine 2.5-star movie, which, you know, that's not bad to get 2.5 stars. That means something that's thoroughly watchable.
Yeah.
Not great, but completely watchable, not a waste of your time. How can he come out and say, I just watched a porn movie, which I'm giving 2.5 stars? You can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to put his credibility on the line like that. There's no advantage for him. All he can do is lose credibility. You know, for every person who's going to say, wow, there are going to be 10 people who are like, what? You're giving 2.5 stars to a porn movie?
So to backtrack slightly for people who aren't familiar with any of your films, how would you describe what you do, particularly with reference to porn that people might have seen?
The underlying premise of my films is that I really, really think the mechanics of sex are beautiful. I love seeing women naked. I love seeing their sex organs. I love seeing their breasts. I love seeing their assholes. I think a woman in a state of sexual availability and showing herself in a way that is inviting and evocative of her own desire and her desire to have you and to please you and to be with you is a tremendously exciting thing. And I think the mechanics of a man and a man, or a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman having sex, the way that body parts penetrate, the way that they glisten, I think those things are beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And the central question in my work is kind of, if I think these things are so beautiful as I see them in my own life in the sexual relationships that I've had, or as I see them in fragments in the world of pornography or explicit sexual imagery, how can I make a film where I can actually watch and enjoy those things instead of what is for me a rather punishing experience to watch a porn movie as I have seen porn? There are fragments within the world of adult filmmaking, you know, porn videos, whatever the word that we want. There are fragments where I go, yes, that's it exactly. That's what I want. But I find that there, for me, are lost within many things that are boring or off-putting or just that fracture the pleasure that I get from seeing the sex. So my whole construct is a way for me personally to be able to see very explicit renditions of sex in a context where what I like about seeing that is left whole and intact, or even hopefully enhanced. And my strategy for doing that is to place the mechanics and the beauty of those mechanics within the context of relationships and within the context of mutual pleasure.
Do you think it's important, because I mean it is a theme of a number of your titles, and you are known for using people in relationships, but do you think is part of what you're trying to do kind of send a message that sex is something that's tied to relationships? And if not, what's your why choose couples over individual performers?
Well, there are three tracks running. They're like braided together, and as the braids touch, they influence each other. One of them is just pure production. What are the resources that I have? You know, the John Cassavetes Award at the Independent Spirit Film whatever thing that mm-hmm. they have, the not the Oscars, uh-huh. the John Cassavetes Award, which is an award for doing something with nothing,
mm-hmm.
is restricted to films with a budget of less than $500,000. That's the John Cassavetes Award. That's the wow, you did this with nothing but a wing and a prayer and $500,000. Good for you. Good. I mean, at the Independent Oscars, the special award for the no budget yeah. achievement is $500,000. I don't have $500,000 to spend on a 90-minute film. Because of my profession, I have a nice inventory of equipment. I've acquired some skills to be able to shoot and to edit. So there are things that I don't have to pay for that some guy who's just walking down the street who's suddenly struck by lightning if he wanted to make a film.
Yeah.
You know, I have, there's probably an MBA name for, you know, it's a kind of capital. That's what I have. I have capital. I have physical capital and I have intellectual capital. And, you know, unlike money, I can spend this and still have it.
Yeah.
So the approach of doing real people was partly in response to what are my resources? My resources are I can shoot on video at first. Now we're shooting on film. You know, we've had some financial success, but at first shooting on film, it's not going to happen. So we have to come up with an idea that will render properly on video. The audience will accept documentary on video far more easily than they'll accept fiction on video. Another part of it is what's the intellectual capital that I have? I make documentary films. That's what I know how to make. I wouldn't have a clue how to direct actors. You know, even if you gave me, you know, a perfect script and you gave me perfect actors, I wouldn't have a clue to where to begin. But I do know how to sit down and talk to people and ask them about the things that I'm interested in, and then coalesce that into a cogent narrative and mix that with illustrative footage to produce something that is nominally watchable. That's what I know how to do. So okay, then it's going to be a documentary. From the audience side, working with people who are already in a sexual relationship, I think there are some people who watch porn. They make the allowances for all the kind of unanswered and uneasy questions that taking strangers and having them go at it on film could bring up. Mm-hmm. And they just, people are aware of that and they accept that in the balance, or they do a kind of a double think where they don't think about all of that. But I think there are a lot of people who, certainly I'm one of them, I find the realities of what it is for two strangers to have sex to be intrusive. And so in having people who have a sexual relationship, I think a lot of the people who enjoy my films, they can stop worrying about the people on screen and what the consequences of them having sex might be. They still might be concerned about the consequences that these people are having sex and their neighbors might find out or their bosses mm-hmm. might find out, and that appearing in one of my films could come back and hurt them in some way.
That's kind of funny. Yeah, we discovered you're having sex with your wife.
Exactly. So even in that, it's like, well, so they got found out doing what we already knew what they were doing. But they certainly, the audience doesn't have to be worried about the consequences of the sex itself, because not that someone couldn't get a disease or couldn't get pregnant on yeah. the set, but they could have also had that same thing happen the day before or the day after.
Yeah.
And so I think it offers a kind of emotional sanctuary for my viewers, because what do you want when you present characters to viewers? You want them to empathize. That's what makes this medium powerful, is that you watch these flickering phosphors on the screen and you respond to them as if it's a person who you know and care about.
Yeah.
But if you start to have that level of empathy for a, you know, a young porn starlet, there are all these, to me, rather upsetting questions that will start to penetrate the little sphere of eroticism that's being created. And the greater degree of empathy, the more those things can start to get drawn in. You start to answer questions about, well, is she really enjoying it? Or if she's not really enjoying it, is she really enjoying to pretend to enjoy it? Or does she just hate it and she's just doing it for the money and you know, and it, just all these things, they're very fracturing of the erotic experience for me, and I wanted to create an environment that was protected from those rather fracturing concerns.
Well, that's interesting to me. I mean, I guess the logical question would be then, if you were to get a call from say someone who's a big name in the world of traditional pornography, who said that they wanted to work with you, what would your reaction be?
There's part of me that would be very interested in that. Prior to actually releasing our first film, my wife and I shot about 10 couples over a period of about 5 years, and we didn't do any interviews with those couples. I get enough sorting through interviews. That's really the hard part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting enough of that doing other work, but there were very specific technical things that I wanted to work out about how do you shoot sex so it feels spontaneous, so that you get the kind of coverage that you need to edit it in a way that makes it seem smooth and exciting and real, and you know, all those things that you want from a proper cinematic experience. And by, you know, working together, we worked out some ideas. I mean, there were literally some points. There's a, you know, talk about kind of fluff action movies. Remember the scenes in Top Gun where they have the little airplanes on the sticks?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
My wife and I would actually debrief after shoots where we had the little artist, those little things that you have, they're about 8 inches tall and they're jointed.
Yeah, maquettes, I think they're called, or something.
We would actually have those with cameras on sticks. And we would debrief after shoots and say, well, okay, I was here, and where were you, and what has that resulted in terms of coverage, and where, what would have been better, and how could we signal each other? How could we know that we needed to move or adjust? And I would like to bring that to some of what I see. I was watching a trailer for a Belladonna flick the other day. It was fetishy and lesbian fetishy, mm-hmm. anal, you know, and it was nasty. And I mean that in a very good way. It was really, really nasty.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to know what that would look like seen through the particular way that we shoot sex. I would like to see how that would change that. Because I wonder, you know, we talk about allowances, that, you know, not everything that happens in Tinseltown is the most upstanding, wonderful, moral, uplifting, win-win for everybody that could possibly happen. But look what we get as a result of it. If you look at, you know, the movies, I mean, you know, it's very, very popular to, you know, call what comes out, you know, pap. But the level of craft that you see even from, like a WB sitcom.
Yeah.
The level of craft there is so high.
Yeah.
And if you and so I wonder sometimes if things just weren't, you know, I mean, how we interpret craft is in some ways personal, but I've been a commercial artist for 20 years, and so I also believe that there are standards, but there's always a balance. As an independent producer, you're telling the audience, I can't give you what you're going to get from going and seeing a DreamWorks film. You know, indulge me, and in exchange, I'll give you something that you won't see in a DreamWorks film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe some of my antipathy towards porn is not so much because I have this, you know, deep and abiding concern that people not, you know, get diseases or unplanned pregnancies. It's just that I don't feel like I get enough for ignoring that possibility.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So I mean, so if a wealthy benefactor was to say, I want you to make a movie for me, here's $5 million, and I want you to spend it on the movie that you're going to make for me, what would you do?
Well, I don't even know that I'd make an erotic film. I maybe over the last 12 months have begun to indulge the notion that, I could direct a narrative, a scripted narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I have some ideas about what I'd like to do with that. Some of the things that I've thought about would be, I would like to see explicit erotic imagery become a part of the filmmaker's palette in the way that the whole rest of the world is part of the filmmaker's palette, and that a filmmaker can choose to include or not to include graphic sexual imagery the way that he would choose to include or not to include graphic violent imagery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's when I was an art student, I was very, very taken with the work of Irving Penn, because he'd take pictures of leaves and cigarette butts and blow them up to monumental size and say, "This matters because I made it."
Mm-hmm.
And you know, being 23, the idea of, you know, that the egotism of that was very, very appealing to me. And what I've learned in the intervening years is that I need strong material. I need the strongest material I can get my hands on to have any hope of making something that anybody would even watch for 30 seconds, you know, let alone sit through an entire half an hour or 45 minutes of what I have. That if I don't work with the strongest material I can get my hands on, I'm sunk. I'm not going to make meditative little films that are, you know, I don't have the eye, I don't have the feel. It's just not me. I need the strongest material possible. Controversy, sex, death, you know, action, whatever, you know, the classic exploitation elements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not little parlor dramas.
Like all the mainstream films I can think of that have what approaches explicit sex, apart from maybe Basic Instinct. You know, I'm thinking of Last Tango in Paris and In the Realm of the Senses. Specifically, they all tend to be about nothing but the sexual relationship between a man and a woman. You know, so it's almost as if sex is such a strong element that filmmakers treat it as if you bring sex into the room, there can be nothing else. If you show these two people having explicit sex, you can't then have a story about the man's problems as a teacher or, you know, his work in the legal service. It has to be about his relationship with his wife and the person he's having sex with.
Yeah, I would, at least at this point in time, I would tend to agree with that. As I, you know, work out ideas, what would I do with it? I mean, if you look at the films that I have and that we have in production, they are about nothing but the relationship, and in particular, the sexual relationship between the two people, and that's absolutely deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point that seeing sex in a cinematic environment is so shocking, you know, in the way that, you know, 100 years ago people were shocked by photography. They were, you know, and I think we still are kind of shocked by photography. It's a very, very new thing in the human experience to see these photorealistic representations, and especially so with sex. It's very, very inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that trying to mix it with other things, I think, is too ambitious at this point, because we don't even have a handle on how to deal with it cinematically. Just the sex itself. So if you find people who are dissatisfied with pornography but like sex and like movies, there's this kind of idea, if only we could just have a regular film with explicit sex scenes. That's kind of, you know,
yeah,
the chestnut. I don't think that would work, because then the whole rest of the film becomes a very expensive wrapper for the sex scenes. I think at this point in time, And this is only as far as I can imagine it, and what I can imagine being able to accomplish, a film with sex has to be about sex, and then anything else that drifts into it in the way that maybe some other aspects of my couple's relationships or experiences drift in, that's just a little, you know, like a little trinket, you
mm-hmm.
know, that you often have in any kind of a film. You have some things that don't, you know, you could put them in or take them out. They're just little decorative elements that don't really mean anything. The story is about, yeah, the person's driving a blue car, they're driving a red car. You have to make a choice. Maybe you choose red because it means something a little bit more, but if it was blue, it wouldn't matter anyway.
Yeah.
And so the criticism that I have of mainstream films that try to tackle explicit sex head on, I never get the sense that the director is excited about the prospect of jerking off the audience. You know, when I watch a horror film, you can just, good horror films drip with the delight the director is taking in scaring the shit out of you.
Mm-hmm.
This is fairly well. They're so impish. A good horror film is so absolutely impish. You can just feel director going, oh, and here's the part where they shit their pants, yeah. And he's just delighted. But the mainstream films that deal with explicit sexuality, the directors always seem to be kind of saying, no, you're not supposed to get a boner. You're not supposed to jerk off at this. This is about. You know, that might work too, but for me at least, I feel like that it's very important, regardless of what I'm doing, whether it's in this documentary format that I've used, or if I were to take on something narrative, that I delight in the fact that my films turn people on and give people boners. I especially delight in the fact that, I mean, I get notes from women telling me that my films make them horny, and I like that a lot. And when I'm making a film, I think very much about the fact that it can, will, and should turn the people on who are watching it. You know, for me, I mean, being able to make films that I know turn on women, that's like being the most popular guy in high school. I mean, I know that sounds petty and small, but I don't care. I like getting notes from women or having women, you know, instant message me and say, oh, your film just, it made me so wet. Yeah, you know, I was not the guy who could, you know, get a date with any chick in high school. And, you know, so I feel like I'm making up ground here. I like it. And I think being turned on about turning people on is really important if you're going to make a sex film, to not be kind of trying to avoid the fact that sex is this very inflammatory, charged material. You have to be, you know. I think that's one of the reasons that John Stagliano has touched a note with so many people with his work, is you get that same kind of impish glee from him doing his thing that you get from a horror film. You kind of, you get the feeling that he is turned on by what he's doing, but he's also turned on at the prospect of turning you, the viewer, on.
So that comes around quite neatly, because again, I think the majority of people who are out there, and particularly the kind of people I've come into contact with.
If I could just interject one thing, I think also there are some feature porn directors who are on the record in saying that the sex bores them. That's really not the part of making a porn feature that interests them. And I can understand, keeping sex interesting is hard. That's why my wife and I were doing the whole little thing with the marionettes. You know, how do you do this so that it won't get boring? But, I mean, how can you make a film that's supposed to make people want to jerk off or make them want to have sex with each other if you think the sex is the boring part of the process?
Yeah, although, I mean, from being, you know, I spent a lot of time living, in the heart of Hollywood and Tinseltown, and actually have worked within both mainstream and adult industries. And one of the things that is very true that a lot of people outside probably don't realize is that there are a lot of people who aren't in porn as a choice. You know, there are a lot of people, particularly behind the camera, because you'd have to be extraordinarily naive in 2005 to think that you could move from porn to a mainstream acting career.
Well,
it's impossible. However, there are a lot of people. All you have to do is look at your video box covers and see how many people are working under pseudonyms. Those pseudonyms aren't because they've got a job working in the local high school. It's because a lot of them are under the impression that their talents can take them out of adult and they can make the films they really want to make, which are mainstream movies. So I know people who write scripts, I know people who direct, I know people who do all kinds of things connected with adult who absolutely think the sex is boring because they see the chance to get a budget from a porn film as a chance to make an independent movie, more power to them on one level, but on the other level, if someone's paying to buy a film that's supposed to have a sexual core, these aren't going to be the people who are going to provide what those people want to see.
Well, and, you know, I couldn't even single out a title if I wanted to, but I don't think that anyone, other than the fact that people have bills to pay, I don't think anybody's getting anywhere getting you know, a third-rate, low-budget film with tepid sex scenes. that just doesn't, you know, that doesn't sound like a very appealing combination. I think, I mean, I've been looking, there are a couple of people, I've only seen trailers for their work. I'm not going to name any names for fear of offending somebody by omission, but I've seen some trailers from some cats that are working in Chatsworth that they seem to be taking kind of almost like a kind of, you know, almost like a kind of a drive-in exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
Very campy, very low budget, where they're kind of telling the viewer, don't take the movie making part of this too seriously. But then within that, they're actually doing some pretty good movie making, you know.
Mm-hmm.
like rack focuses that actually are there for more than to show off the fact that they have one of those rack focus, you know, the kind of work that I do. I don't own, that's one of the things I don't have. I know they have a name where you have to have a second person turn them, and I've actually seen some rack focuses in these trailers for their work that at least in the context of the trailer would appear to be something more than showing off the fact that they own this piece of equipment. Or
yeah.
or match cuts that don't say, look, a match cut. They're seamless and you wouldn't notice them unless you were looking, and, you know, from a craft point of view. And I think that maybe that approach of kind of a campy, because again, there's always, you know, unless you're DreamWorks, even if you're DreamWorks, you're making a bargain with the audience. And that bargain is, here's what I can't do. Here's everything that you're not going to get. You know, if it's DreamWorks, it's only going to be shadows on the screen. It's not actually life that you're floating around in. But there's always a kind of a bargain that you set out and you make with the audience in the beginning. And I think a lot of porn features fail because they strike a bargain that they can never live up to. They're just, you know, on a $120,000 budget where a proportionally a huge amount of that, you know, if you were making an independent film on $120,000, nobody would be getting paid anything, and you'd still pay $120,000 to do the thing. You make a porn film, and you're already spending a huge portion of that paying people to have sex, so that you're actually, and then you have to pay people to, you know, everyone has to get paid on that budget. So
yeah.
your budget relative to an independent film, it's like you're making an independent film for $10,000, and you know. I think that a lot of porn features strike. They strike a bargain they can't, like I said, that they can't live up to. They've got people driving cars that are, you know, it's like, no, people should be driving Chevettes, not a Porsche. It's all out of balance. And I think that some of these cats that I've seen are kind of getting more down to a kind of a guerrilla or indie aesthetic. With the thing that I wonder, and I guess I'm going to have to watch some of these films, is how disruptive is it? You know, first of all, if you take all of like 90 minutes worth of film, then you take the best, you know, like any other film, you put the best of it in the trailer, it can look pretty fucking good, and then you have to watch the whole thing, and it's like, oh.
Trailers are just awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, just trailers, if I always come at, whenever I watch a trailer, I always think, if you can't make a trailer that kicks ass, if you can't turn your $50 million budget into 2 minutes of absolutely edge of the seat brilliantness, you've got no chance at all. Exactly. Trailers are the best, because if I see a bad trailer, the chances of that movie getting my money are effectively zero. Because I think, look, you can't do it for 90 seconds. God knows 90 minutes.
Yeah. But I think that maybe conceptually that these cats are on the right track. That rather than trying to present fantasies about, you know, people who live in mansions and drive sports cars, and, you know, because then you've got all the wardrobe has to be Armani, and all the teeth has to be straight, and there can't be any, you know, like once you're into that kind of arch realm of fantasy, then everything has to measure up, otherwise it looks very, very, very thin.
Yeah, you can't, well, that's also the thing. I mean, the look and feel, especially, and you know, you feel it when you're in Los Angeles and you're in Southern California, because so much of what's exported worldwide as America is, you know, 20 square miles around Los Angeles.
Mm.
And it's really easy to go and rent a house that in most parts of the world just looks like a palace. you know, and then it's not that difficult to get your hands on a car. But you look at the difference between a porn film shot in a glossy house and a Michael Mann movie, and you can really you can see the difference.
Yeah. It's a universe away. And the thing that I really hate about that is you end up with a girl who might very well be, you know, one of the prettiest girls in high school, and that's very, very, very pretty. But she is not Michael Mann feature film flawless.
No.
She just isn't. And doesn't have all of the other ancillary crafts around her, the hair, the makeup, the wardrobe.
Oh yeah.
So she ends up looking kind of lost and a little bit silly.
Yeah.
And that that makes me upset. That makes me upset, the prospect that you have a woman who's beautiful and actually wants to be there. You know, I mean, one of the things, you know, why do I use real couples? I want to work with people for whom the opportunity to be on camera is exciting rather than another, you know, another job. I want that to be something that's going to heighten their experience and be a special experience. So, you know, if you had this woman for whom being a sex performer was a real calling, and you know, a vocation like the clergy vocation, you know, which, and I don't think that that's a completely silly thing to say, that someone could really feel that they are being who they were meant to be by having sex for the pleasure of other people to watch. I don't think that that's silly, but but then to take someone like that and then to make her look less than by surrounding her with an over-the-top mansion and an over-the-top car, this is sound really sappy, but it breaks my heart a little bit.
Yeah,
think that you could take that person and you could put them in an environment that was more that would really show them off instead of putting them down.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, and I mean, I'm calling you right now. I travel a lot, and I've been spending a lot of time in Eastern Europe, and I'm calling you from Riga in Latvia. So I am an hour by plane from Moscow, and Riga has the highest proportion of women to men of any city on the planet. It's something like 53% female, but it feels like a lot more because you see women everywhere, and you really whatever that 2% difference is. But anyway, the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life, I've seen in Latvia as a whole. And I've been, you know, I've traveled a bit. I've been to most countries in Europe. I've been to places in America. What's amazing to me is that when I speak to people here and they find out that I'm from Hollywood, quite often women will say to me, staggeringly beautiful women will say to me, you know, I've always dreamt of being an actress, but I don't think I look good enough. And you sit there and I try and explain to them, you look so much better than real movie stars who I've met out. But if they don't have the $7,000 a week hairdresser, you can't match it. And it's really not, you know, I mean, you talk about people, you talk about the prettiest girl in high school not looking good by comparison. It's really a special effect. I mean,
That's exactly right. It is a special effect.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely know a hairdresser in Hollywood who gets paid $7,000 a week for doing hair for a performer on a movie. $7,000 a week. I mean, that's just for one character's hairdresser, let alone the rest of the movie.
And you're only ever allowed to see the images that were exactly perfect. Like, I tried to, if you go on my website, you'll find some production stills where I have long hair, because I decided that I, as I was approaching middle age, that I needed to make one more stab at being a very sexy man. So I let my hair grow for about 2 years. And it just made me insane. I have a lot of hair, so it's just all over the place, and it's kind of curly, and I end up looking like a beast that wandered out of the woods. And I'm like, how come I don't look like Mel Gibson? What the fuck? You know, I've got better hair than he does, you know? I mean, every time I go to a hair cutter, they're like, oh, you have the most amazing hair. Oh, yeah, I've got gray hair. How come I don't look like fucking Mel Gibson, you know? Well, it's because the only pictures that I ever see of Mel Gibson, the stylist was in there 2 seconds before the exposure, getting everything right in place.
Yeah.
And you can't do that in porn. Our budgets are so infinitesimally small that you can't do that. So you have to create constructs that let people be how they are.
Yeah.
And look beautiful and appealing and empathetic and sexy. being how, more kind of how you find them. Even then, you have to do a lot of framing and make choices and try to be as flattering as you can, because mm-hmm. you want to take reality with air quotes and make it a kind of a kind of an idealization of reality. But you can't be off in that kind of that Hollywood dream machine world, because none of, you know, unless you've actually been there and seen, you've hit the exact word. It is a special effect. It is a special effect. It's not hair and makeup. It's special effects.
And these, and the, and even when you, even if you try and water it down, although, you know, the first thing you think, when someone's being paid $1,000 a day for attaching one person's hair, you think that's insane. Then again, when you see what they're capable of, you know that even if you were able to afford to get your local hairdresser down on set to focus on doing things, they wouldn't do the same thing. You know, these people have, these people are the best at what they do in a really incredibly niche way. I actually, I'm lucky enough to have a friend who's a really serious, world-famous photographer, and he's a good friend of mine. And I've been in his house before, and I needed a photograph. So I basically threw him my new camera phone and said, you know, you're the person who knows how to use a camera. Can you take a picture of me? What he can do with a camera phone, I can't do with a 35mm camera, you know, because he has the skills. So, you know, even when you take those people out of context, there's just no way you can, there's no way you can match it unless you have those, unless you have those skills. It's really, it's astounding to see. And when you have the kind of limitless supply of money and then the limitless supply of ability, you know, as you said, the people who are doing, sitcoms on the WB, are still 1,000 times better than almost anyone else you could name.
And basically, the only thing that I have is a novel idea. That's the extent of my resources in any kind of comparison to movie making or television making at large. I have a novel idea.
Yeah.
And so much of what I do is devoted to not highlighting, doing as much as I can to make sure not to highlight the fact that that's all that I have.
Well, to change tack slightly, one of the things that I would love to get your opinion on, because we've been talking about the industry kind of as a whole, but to be specific, and maybe with, you know, we don't have to name names, but you know, we are living in a world where the Attorney General is making a real run at porn in the first. Kind of serious attack on the adult industry since the 1980s. And there's, aside from the kind of immediate knee-jerk typical industry reaction of leave us alone, we can do what we want, there's also a good deal of kind of public concern over the state of modern adult material, because there's definitely a line in the sand between people having sex and fooling around, and some of the stuff that at least looks on the surface to be pretty, you know, pretty dark. There's a lot of stuff that is kind of in the realms of extreme S&M, but it isn't marketed as such. And because it's not marketed as such, it freaks people out even more. You know, if these people were in rubber masks with Nine Inch Nails playing in the background, you'd go, what you get. But when they're dressed up normally, you think, oh my God, are these people into it? What is your take on the state of the modern industry? And do you think modern industry can survive without changing?
Unfortunately, there are too many examples within the adult industry of things that I think many people feel extremely uncomfortable defending on anything other than a principle. And that's you know, who wants to get up and say, no, don't prosecute Rob Black? I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I believe that on principle that his prosecution is preposterous, but do I want to get up and actually say in front of regular people that it's very important that Rob Black have the freedom to do vomit porn, that the future of the Republic hangs in the balance? I do believe that, but it's very, very uncomfortable to say that. That girls pooping must be protected. Unless we protect girls pooping, then our future is in doubt. And the problem is that there's not the elegant side of that argument. There's not the beautiful work that would say, oh, well, yeah, we're protecting that too. And we do have the beautiful work in literature. We have controversial, dark. We have, you know, End of Alice, which I don't even know if that's a beautiful work, but it's unmistakably a work of literature. Exploitive, yes. Provocative, yes. Disgusting, yes. But you're not gonna get any traction for trying to ban End of Alice.
Yeah,
it's on Amazon. I mean, it's and we don't have anything like that within the world of sexually explicit moving imagery, where people say, yes, this is a tremendously uncomfortable work.
Yeah, I think.
But I feel comfortable standing up for it, not on principle, but on the merit of the work itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately, American society, as someone who lives within it a lot of the time, but is also outside of it, there's a real tear, because although you say no one's thinking of banning End of Alice, they are bolderizing Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer in high school. The freedom of speech in America is a really interesting conundrum, because it's an idea, it's not an actuality. Technically, there's no censorship, but as soon as you put something controversial in front of Americans, they'll choose to censor it. In the same way that technically you can release anything as a movie, but everyone knows if it doesn't get a rating, if you can't even get it rated NC-17,
right.
You're effectively banned from because there are theaters just won't play it, with very, very few exceptions.
Well,
so with the kind of video stuff, I think, you know, one of the reasons the video stuff is getting in, sticking in people's craws, because in a society where people aren't reading books, it seems that much more immediate or threatening. But if you put End of Alice in front of the same people who are upset about hardcore video, they would lose their minds. I think the other thing, you know, regarding your comment about the, you know, a kind of a sterling example, I think the other really interesting thing, and this is not an argument on my part for limiting people's expression, but it, you know, to use music as an example, if you have a kind of area which is a playground for ideas, the most interesting stuff happens not at the very edges, but in from the edges just a little bit. Because almost every artistic endeavor, when you push things to the nth degree, you know, when you just stick a video camera and you just video the roof of a building for 20 hours, it's an interesting intellectual argument, but you seldom make some art that people connect with emotionally or fall in love with, even though you might open the door to something that does connect with people. So I think, you know, unfortunately, the people who are on the very edge are kind, you know, what we really need, or I think the adult industry really needs to kind of prove its worth artistically, is just better product. It doesn't need to be at the very, very edges. It just needs to be, it needs to offer something clearly other than kind of thrill kill value. And I think the problem is, when you look at some of the work that's out there that's being obviously picked on, there's nothing in it other than, you know, how far can we push things? You know, it's
the problem is that, you know, you're talking about a very successful DVD moving 5,000 units. Well, that's, you know, At a typical wholesale price point, you're looking at, you know, maybe putting $50,000 or $75,000, maybe, into the pocket of the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're working in the moving image, that doesn't give you very much to work with.
Yeah.
And so I think it becomes kind of self-feeding. It's like, oh, well, I'm not getting enough money here on any one effort to do very much. So there are two things that are kind of come out of that. One is, I'm going to have to do a lot more to make money.
Mm-hmm.
The volume of work that I put out is going to have to go up just to have a comfortable middle class living. I'm going to have to churn out a tremendous amount of work, which is going to further suppress the top of what it might be creatively or artistically or in terms of, you know, its production competence.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, it's going to make a very crowded market where everyone's jostling trying to get noticed, and since you can't get noticed by doing it better, the economics of the industry kind of foreclose the option of doing it better, so your only real option is to do it louder.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what does louder mean in porn? It means, well, okay, we have a dick in our pussy and we have a dick in our ass, you know, and I know plenty of women who like that. That's, you know, that's kind of old hat. But if we want to go louder with that, we better, you know, put two dicks up her ass, you know. Like, ah, well, then how about three dicks up her ass? Or, you know, or, mm-hmm. or here's a woman servicing six men, you know, who doesn't like that? How about a woman servicing 50 men, you know, it's like, you know, I know women who like servicing 6 or 10 men. I don't know any women who like servicing 50 men, at least not what you actually get to show up when you need 50 to show up. You know,
yeah.
Kind of, you know,
yeah.
you've already got diminishing returns working against you, even if you were getting guys that were walking out of her Brits calendars. You're still working against the concept of diminishing returns, except you can't even maintain quality. So none of the women that I know that like, you know, taking on guys a half a dozen or so at a time have any interest in anything other than the fantasy of 20 or 40 or 50, and the reality of how that's rendered is, well, you know, I mean, it's sort of like video cameras, you know, with 10x, well, okay, we want to get the consumer's attention, I guess the next iteration of cameras has to have 20x on the barrel of the lens, and then, well, okay, we've already done 20x, now I'm seeing cameras that, you know, consumer cameras that have things like 100x or 300x, I guess because they're, you know, doing some digital interpolation. Those are meaningless numbers in terms of actually doing anything with the camera, but they are very large numbers that you can put on the barrel of the lens. So, you
yeah.
know, so you can, instead of like gangbang, you can say 20-man gangbang or 50-man gangbang or 100-man gangbang. There's no, I don't even know if there's any kind of circus value to that. I think that's even getting beyond circus value. It's just like putting 320x on the barrel of a video camera. It's just a bigger number in the hopes of breaking through the clutter, a clutter which is self-perpetuated by a way of doing business that means that to make any money you have to turn out a huge volume of titles.
Yeah, it's just it's dumb marketing. It's I mean, it's really interesting to see. Even now, the bigger companies, you know, I mean, the biggest company, Vivid, puts out less product than their competitors, but spends more time selling it. And it's very interesting to me. I think maybe this is because I have I'm a marketing guy in many ways. But I think, to be honest with you, a lot of it is because good marketing is hard. But in a way, it's harder to market, to sell something well, than it is just to bang out another tape, especially if the tape is as low quality as a lot of the stuff out there. So, you know,
well, and if the quality of what, you know, there's this, you know, you can sell shit in a can, well, once or twice. But if the quality of what you're making is already kind of capped by the pace and the budget that you have, you
know,
the budget of time,
yeah.
then there's no upside in good marketing because
yeah.
Good marketing is never going to move you from, you know, from 2,000 to 4,000.
Yeah, and you can't sell crap.
You've got your product, it has a number, you know, a certain number of people who accept the bargain that you make with them, but you can't, maybe once or twice you can, but as an ongoing thing, you can't tell people they're getting one thing and then give them another. So there's no amount of clever marketing that's gonna move, you know, marketing is something you want to move things by an order of magnitude. That's,
yeah.
You know, like, oh, if we sell this right, we go from selling 1,000 to selling 10,000. Now the marketing effort, you know, and then you get everything feeding in, and, oh, we have more money, we can do a better job. So when we tell, you know, it's just, you know, so there's kind of a stasis between the time budget, production budget, potential market. There's just kind of a stasis that I think has been reached within a lot of aspects of the industry. But again, I'm only kind of gleaning that as someone who's very outside. I don't have any, you know, special access to, like I said, to what people are actually moving. I can only infer by what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. And I think that looking back, you know, Comstock is on the vanguard of doing things differently in a more genuine way. I think it will be very interesting to see. I also think that if things do continue on in the way that they seem to be going, I'm sure that your company is going to be looked to as an example. You might not realize it, but you'll probably be held up as the Ulysses that you talked about, as the example of quality.
Well, no, we don't want that. No, because Ulysses ended up in court. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be, I have this thing that I like doing and I feel, embarrassingly passionate about. I believe that what I'm doing matters. It matters to me. And it seems to matter to some people who send me some very nice notes. And I feel lucky that it's all kind of come together in a way that there doesn't, the only limit on being able to continue would seem to be whether or not my novel idea continues to be sufficiently novel that people want to trade money for another chance to roll around in it for, 45 minutes or an hour.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Tony. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to talk to me and the people listening. And I will make sure, well, I will advise them to go and check out the podnography.com website for a link to your website and your blog.
Oh, right. I guess I should say that. It's www.comstockfilms.com.
And there will be a link to that on the Podnography website and in the show notes, so you will not miss it. And if they were to go in, if people were to go and buy one tape to get an impression of what you do, or one DVD, what am I saying, tape? I sound like someone's grandparent. One cylinder. If they were to buy one DVD, what would you, which would you recommend?
I mean, currently, if they want to get one today, we only have two titles that are currently available today. One is Marie and Jack, a hardcore love story, which is our first release. The other is Xana and Dax, When Opposites Attract, which is our sophomore release, our follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
They're both good. I think that Xana and Dax is closer to what it is that I'm driving at. But it should be, right? It's the next one. If it was further away, that'd be cause for concern. Not that that doesn't happen, but I was very, very relieved to see that the second film actually got closer to what it is that I had in mind. It's a little bit tough. I don't think of people watching my... I don't think of my films made to be watched from the point of view of, do you like exotic-looking brunettes, or do you like bosomy blondes? But that's still a big part of how people experience pornography or erotic films. So I think which one of those a person would enjoy more is largely a matter of their own personal proclivities and tastes.
Well, then I would just recommend that everyone goes out and buys both of them.
Okay, right. There we go. So,
thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And I'll speak to you soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.
That's it for Podnography Show 12. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out podnography.com for past shows, fleshbot.com for daily sex news, and sugarbank.com for more of me. My name's Sam Sugar, and that was Podnography.